Thank you.
Twenty more minutes of accolades would have been nice. Bob Darrow, I am alcoholic. And only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, because I didn't think he could love a guy like me. But I've accessed through the process of the 12 steps, and I maintain that grace in my life through those actions, and an ability to remain reasonably sponsorable, and a persistent and consistent effort in our primary purpose of helping other drunks. I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering substance since October 31st, 1978. And that's the great miracle that Alcoholics Anonymous has brought into my life. Sometimes I find it hard to believe not only that I've stayed sober and reasonably well-balanced, even though it's in dispute, for all those years, is that I've never left the middle of AA. I've never stopped doing this whole thing. And I'm a guy that I get tired of a shirt after about a month. You know what I mean? I've never got tired of AA, and I've never got tired of being with you and the amazing feeling of usefulness that I get occasionally when I do what God's designed me to do. I want to thank Mr. Anderson, which that sounds like the Matrix, doesn't it? Just thank Dick and the members of this committee. I am honored to be here with some of the great heroes in my life. The speakers are fantastic. Polly, I just love Polly. If you were to look up unconditional love in the dictionary, you'd see her picture. She's one of the... If I need to get beat up, I call my sponsor. If I need to get nurtured, I call Polly. It's just, you know, it's like... And when she was sharing... Ralph, I was sitting next to Ralph, and she was sharing about how she was envious about never sleeping with a one-legged preacher. I turned to Ralph, and I said, "Have you ever regretted not sleeping with a one-legged preacher?" And he just hung his head. He wouldn't even answer me. And I thought, that's why he quit going to church when he was 16. Oh my God. Wow. And the speakers, last night, the speakers all this whole weekend, Polly and Dave and Michael, and the Al-Anon the family meeting was very touching Thursday night. If you hadn't been there, it was really moving. And we got some great guys coming up. Mari is one of my favorite people in AA. She's very principled and yet has a decrepit sense of humor, which I kind of enjoy. You know who's a her husband. Her husband has the most perverted, sick sense of humor I have ever met. I can have a day when I don't feel very good about myself. 5 minutes around him and I feel like a saint. I mean, it's my lower companion. And tomorrow, one of the great gentlemen of Alcoholics Anonymous, really what I think all of us would aspire to be one day, what the picture of an elder statesman, Tom, is going to talk, and I love to listen to Tom. Tom's what I'd like to be when I grow up. I know some of you are thinking, yeah, that'll never happen, but Tom is what I'd like to be when I grow up. I'm supposed to talk about two steps that I think are often overlooked. I'm surprised with the guys I sponsor, and some of them may be sober a long time, 25, 30 years, that will have a crisis in their life, and they're looking in all the wrong places, and the problem is really step six. The problem is really, it lies within that, but they don't think so because they're up into some advanced 11-step thing, and The problem's really in step six. I did what a lot of us do. You know, in the big book, it starts this process, and it talks about something that my grand sponsor, Chuck Chamberlain, used to talk about. When Chuck used to say, this is an inside job. And in step one, in the third chapter, it talks about step one differently. It says we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves. And I think that that's where everything has to happen here. This can never be academic. It can never be placated by knowledge. It has to be down in here. And so consequently, guys like me who are thinkers and we live in our heads, a lot of innermost self doesn't get done because I live up here in the control center where I analyze and figure the universe. And so a lot of that doesn't get done. So what happened to me when I finally did my first what I consider legitimate, genuine fourth and fifth step. And the reason I say that was my third in this stint of sobriety, but it was the first one where I followed the procedure in the book, and it revolutionized my whole outlook towards life. I mean, it really changed my whole perception. And all of a sudden, I looked at the world very differently, and I could see where I was wrong about my mother and father, and on and on and on and on. And it was miraculous. It was amazing transformation in perception. But I have always been a guy that unconsciously believed that knowledge was power. And so I came out of the fifth step to approach my step six and seven and just sort of intellectually placated step six, entirely ready. Oh, of course. Entirely ready is, entirely is like more than half. Entirely is like, wow, entirely? When you really, in the innermost self, get entirely, you'll go, oh, what, in order? I can't go through. Yeah, I mean, entirely. Wow, entirely. Well, I wasn't really. I was entirely ready to have God remove the consequences of some of this stuff. But you can't separate the wheat from the chaff like that. Bill, in his story, talks about his, you know, when Bill goes through the thumbnail sketch of his experience going through the steps with Abby, he talks about step six and seven in a little different context than anywhere else in AA literature. When he says that he asked his creator to remove these sins, and he says root and branch. And the implication is there's two parts. There's the branch, which is poking me in the eye, that's giving me problems. That's the consequences. That's the result. That's the price I'm paying here for this self-defending, self-grandizing, self-gratifying, self-exciting behavior. And I'm willing to give up the consequences, but there's a root. There's some delusion of pleasure or value or security within the defect every single time without exception. And the problem is I don't understand that, really. I understand consequences. See, I'm a guy who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the real truth is I'm in a lot of trouble, but I don't really want to change. I want relief. And if you don't want to change, if you have an ego that has a greater survival mechanism than you do, and it does not and will not and fights and squirms to be in control, And change is tough. Change is very difficult. So what happens to a lot of us, and I'm not alone, I see this in the guys I sponsor, and I just have to sometimes sit back and watch and suggest that they do certain prayers and immerse themselves in service and hope that enough grace comes in to cause something to happen. But I want relief. Is what I really want. And if you're a relief seeker, as Silkworth says something interesting when he talks about us when we get sober, he says, we become restless, irritable, and discontented unless I can again experience that sense of ease and comfort that I had once, but I'm 10 years sober, that I had once found in taking a few drinks. So in my abstinence, I become a relief seeker, an ease and comfort junkie, looking for ease and comfort. And there's a lot of, you can get a lot of ease and comfort here. You can get a lot of relief here. But the problem with relief, if you're like me, is it the shine of it wears off so quickly, and you need more relief. It's an insatiable thing because it's inadvertently, it makes you feel better, but you're really feeding self. And the problem is, I don't know that. I don't know that. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just, I don't feel good, and I'm trying to feel better. And one of the things that saved my life, and with the guys I sponsor, I just tell them, you're just going to do 12-step work, and you're going to do service, and you're going to immerse yourself in that venue, and you're going to do it like a crazy person, and we're going to hope that that's going to save you from you. Because what happens in service and in 12-step work is that the ego will temporarily and intermittently get pushed aside and grace comes in. And eventually that cooks stuff out of you that never would be cooked out any other way. So I'm a relief seeker, and the problem is, it's just like Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about, that if he used to talk about us sober, and he said you eventually get to a place where you can no longer put anything between you and you. And then you know the same thing I knew at the end of my drinking. There is no combination of alcohol and pills. There's no combination of nothing. This is a dead horse. And sometimes when you get to that place with things that worked at one time, just like I did with drinking, it's easy to go to God. And that's where it has to go. Lack of power really is my dilemma. What I did is I get through step five, and I see all these things that are on, all these manifestations of self are on paper, and I just talked about them in step five, and I get that they're objectionable. I get that there's a cause and effect here with consequences and problems, and I understand that. And so I'm just not going to be that way ever again. See, lack of power really is my dilemma. Bill says something funny on page 101. And it's funny. If you could talk everything that he talks about in relationship to our powerlessness over alcohol, you can apply it to all of this stuff too. And it's right on the money. He says, any scheme of combating alcoholism, which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation, is doomed to failure. And this is beautiful. This is the cause and effect. He says, if the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. What I suppress, I give torque to. There's a law in the universe. For every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. And whatever I willfully or egotistically subvert, push down, it seems to gain power. And so what happened to me is I went through close to a decade that was very painful because I understand intellectually these things I got to stop doing, and I would stop doing them. And I become the reformed that guy. You know what that's like? The reformed smoker you light up a cigarette and he gives you a lecture about lung cancer. I become that guy in every defect of character. Well, one of the things that happened to me is it became so apparent as a result of my resentment list. You know, I had all my resentments are just judgments. I said, oh my God, I'm so pathetically, childishly judgmental, because by the time I did my first legitimate fourth step, I was sober over 4 years, so everybody on it almost is in AA. You know what I mean? I mean, well, I notice what's wrong with you easily. I just do it. It's a gift. And so, but you kind of look at that and you process that through. This was our course, and you put yourself in their shoes and you see that I'm an idiot. That's what you basically say. I'm wrong. I'm an idiot. And so I think, oh my God, I'm so pathetically judgmental. I am just not going to be that guy ever again. And the moment I willfully took the position of I'm not going to be judgmental, I started noticing the judgmental people in AA. Do you know what I mean? It was like they just, like all of a sudden had neon around them. I could just see them. And I became the judger of the judgmental. Which is like crazy. It's you know, it's like that game in the kids' arcade called Whack-A-Mole, right? Where you whack-a-mole down in this hole and it pops up over here. It's kind of like that. I went through a period I almost died at a year and a half sober. I learned something that was astounding to me. And it was the same thing I learned when I was brand new. You know, something happened to Bill Wilson, and it happened to me, but I was afraid to really acknowledge it until I was sober a long time. Bill, I was in the detox the last time in 1978, and in a moment of desperation, I fell down to my knees in that hospital room by myself, and I beg to God that I don't even believe in and that I am afraid of for help. And the obsession to drink left me on that moment. And except for one little thing at about 19 years sober that was very brief, and it hasn't returned. It just pulled it right up out of me. And I was the guy who'd been a chronic relapser for 7 years. I fought this thing. I prayed. I went to therapy. I did everything. And God took it. And when I was about a year and a half sober, I was suicidal. I came out of a casino on a Friday night. I'd just been paid. And I was broke. I jacked my whole paycheck off. And the problem is, by this time, I'm behind with my utilities and my roommate. I already owe him, I owe everybody money, and I don't have any money to pay my part of the rent, utilities. I don't have gas for my car. I don't have cigarette money, food money, and it's Friday, and I don't get paid for another week. And I'll tell you, I was suicidal. And from my innermost self, I begged God to remove this thing from me. And he took it up out of me like, poof. It was amazing. And I didn't place a bet for about 25 years. And then I retired and I had a lot of money. And I know things because I'm a smart guy. And smart guys know that the stock market's not really gambling. And it came back in a different form. Right? And I had to do the same thing. Only this time, it was like it is often for guys like me. I prayed about it, 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 day in and day out. I could not stop trading stocks. I would beg God in the morning, please take this away from me, and I'd go and trade stocks. And it was about 6 months later, I woke up one morning and something had happened to me. And it was the same thing that had happened to me when I started to pray for the desire not to smoke cigarettes. It took about 6 months, and then one morning I woke up and I had never had a cigarette since. And I don't do that. And I woke up one morning and I sold all that whole portfolio and I just walked away. And I've been free of it ever since. So sometimes God moves quickly if the desperation and the need is strong enough, and sometimes he moves slowly. And I often wonder which is the greater gift. I don't know. Maybe the slow. But I'll tell you something. I have never, in 34 years, I have never had anything in my life that I want to be free of, that if I make it a serious piece of spiritual business in my life, and sometimes it takes months of praying about it twice a day, that God will remove it in time. But I have to do my part. I have to keep it a piece of spiritual business in my life. And I'll tell you something. There is a tremendous amount of security in that for me, because I know I don't have to be perfect. I just have to have God in my life. And there's a couple things in my life today that I... You know, there was a great doctor who died many years ago, with almost 60 years, I think, of sobriety. Tom might have known Dr. Gill. He lived up in the Bay Area. And Gill used to say there's three phases of alcoholism: the fun phase, the fun and problems phase, and the problems phase. I think there's three phases of defects. I think there's the time when they work and they're, oh, my God, this is really very cool. And then there's this is very cool, but look what's happening over here. And then this is just, look what's happening, and it's bad. And I think sometimes, maybe for guys like me, sometimes that's part of the entirely ready process, I guess. I don't know. But I know that God's there for me. And if I ever get serious about anything, no matter what it is, I can count on him as long as I will do the work. I think there's an old adage in AA that without him I can't, but without me he won't. You know, I have to show up here. That's why everything in Alcoholics Anonymous that has to do with God usually has to do with actions in conjunction with the prayer. So I have to show up in my life as if I mean it. I have to take the actions as if I... It's easy to say to myself, oh yeah, I'm entirely willing. But when I start to act like it by praying about it every single day, then I'm doing my part. And I love that. I just... You know, AA is very, very different from a lot of spiritual organizations, a lot of churches. Most churches... If you're a sinner, they kind of want you to join. Yeah, come on in. But, you know, once you're in, they sort of expect you to stop sinning. It's implied in the brochure. I mean, you know, now that you're here, straighten up. We don't do that in AA at all. Matter of fact, we're almost the opposite. We're just like, sin as long as you can stand it. I got a guy right now that's doing some pretty bizarre stuff. And we're just, me and some of the other guys I sponsor, we have this attitude like, oh, he's going to help a lot of people with this, you know? And if we can keep him immersed in service and AA, keep him praying and keep him being helping guys, God will work through that. And he'll get to the end of the string with it. And if he's done some damage, he'll have to come and make it right, because nobody else will. I like that about AA. I like that. This is the only place I've ever been where I could be as flawed as I am, and it was okay, and it was all right. And you've allowed me to grow into a relationship with God and a relationship with you, and to become the guy God would have me be at a very, very slow pace. But it is the pace. I don't think the caterpillar is yelling out to God, hurry up, I want to be a butterfly. I think he's just hanging out, letting it happen. And one of the great blessings of service in Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsoring people is that it just makes it all come true. It makes it all happen. There's a couple ways guys like me become entirely ready. And one of them, of course, and we all know this, is by pain. You know, we don't give stuff up. We wear it out. I mean, it's been a dead stinking carcass in the road for about a week now. But every once in a while, I'm jumping on it and giving it the crop, you know, thinking it's going to get up and ride, you know. And then when I finally exhaust all possibility that there's anything good left here, it's like, then I take it to God and I'll go to meetings and take credit for overcoming it. Of course I do. That's the kind of ego I got, right? But I love that line, of myself I'm nothing, the Father doeth the work. And I don't change it. I change my clothes, God does everything else, you know. I can change some of my actions. And that's my participation in this thing that happens to people like me here, is I can take the actions. And I can do that. But I do not make the change. I don't have the power for the change. Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about, one time he's talked about sitting in his house up on the hill in Laguna Beach and looking out at the ocean to Catalina Island. And he said he would sit there and watch the sailboats tack out to Catalina. And he said it didn't matter how expensive a boat it was. It didn't matter the cut of the jib. It only mattered was the set of the sail. And you guys have given me actions that I can take that let me catch the grace, that will take me where I need to go, because I can't go there. I don't have any power here. Running my life on my own power is like having an outboard motor in a cesspool. Not only doesn't it take you anywhere, but it stirs up a lot of crap, I'm telling you. And so I have stayed immersed in this altruistic movement of service, of love and service for all these years. And God has had his way with me. And it's been good. Sometimes it's not just out of pain that I become entirely ready. Sometimes it's out of inspiration. I'll tell you, if I sponsor you, you sponsor people. And I'll tell you why, is because God will work through the people you sponsor to bring you to places that you could not be brought to any other way. One of the things that happens to you once you're sober a number of years and you're sponsoring a bunch of people is that you start to realize that this awkward realization that you may not want this, but you are the example of Alcoholics Anonymous they turn to, that they look at on how to conduct their life. And if you start to get that and you love the people you sponsor, and how could you not love them when they have opened up their hearts to you, when you have been there for the birth of their kids, where you've been there as the homeless guy bought his first house, how could you not love them? And then you realize that you're the example. And then you have those moments where you think, I'm not a very good example. And I think for some of us, within our innermost self, we will find the desire to come to God and become entirely ready with stuff out of my love for you. If it was just a matter of pain, 3-4 more years. But because it's you. I think it's odd. I'm sober in this room. I wouldn't consider myself an old timer. I'm a little medium timer, I guess. But even sober over 33 or 34 years, if I were to step back from my life objectively, I could tell you that there's still quite a bit of evidence that I must not have a really high self-esteem, because I show evidence in my actions and emotions as if I care more about you than I do about me. You know how you can tell when one of your close friends or a sponsee has something wrong with them and they don't want to go to the doctor? You'll get them to the doctor. If it's me, I'm all right, thank you. Right? I care more about you than I do about me. That's the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that our love for one another seems to supersede our own sort of dislike of ourselves and our secret feelings of self-loathing. Why would a guy like me have self-loathing with a lot of years of sobriety? Because I got this reoccurring and reactivating ego that says things to me like, if you're not perfect, you're not worth anything at all. Right? And so I sponsor guys, and they change me. And that's good. I was thinking one time about, what is this this thing that makes me hold on to stuff that intellectually I understand. I really should be ready to have God take this, but I still cling to it. It took me close to a decade after I did my fifth step to realize there was a sixth step prayer. I didn't see it. I don't know if that was convenient, or I just really didn't see it. But there's a sixth step prayer where I'm asking God, if I still cling to something, I will not let go, that I ask Him for the willingness. And I came back at many years of sobriety and said that prayer, and I started noticing something that started to happen in my life. And God is a much gentler way to go. And that's, I think, was part and parcel of when I started changing my perception of some things in my life and coming to God based on what was happening in my life and how it was reflecting on the people I sponsor. There was a TV show on television when I was a little kid, and it really affected me. And years later in sobriety, I thought, that is exactly what Step 6 is about. And the show was called Rescue 8. And there was this one episode where the show was about these paramedics that worked out of a firehouse. And they would go out on these distress calls where people were in trouble, and they'd go out to help. And this one particular episode, these two paramedics arrive on this scene, and there's this cute little girl, and she's crying, and she's evidently in pain, and her arm is wedged up into a vending machine, and they're trying to get it out, and her mother and father have been trying to get it out, and they can't get it out. It's wedged up in there, and she's very upset, and the parents are very upset, and they don't know what to do, and now the fire trucks start showing up, and they're pulling off torches and saws off the truck, and they're talking about cutting the door around the arm, and this is just making the little girl scared even more. And the one paramedic's watching all this, and he goes over and he kneels down next to the little girl, and he says, "Sweetheart, do you got something in your hand?" She goes, "Uh-huh. What do you got in your hand?" "A candy bar." "Would you let go of it?" "No, it's my candy bar. It's my candy bar. It's my pornography. It's my gambling. It's my cheating at work. It's my fudging my expense account. It's my. And she won't give it up. And he doesn't know what to do, so he backs off. And he's standing there, and something comes to him. You could tell something in his face, and he kneeled back down to her again, and he said, "Sweetheart, I'll make you a promise. If you'll let go of that candy bar, I promise you I'll get you two candy bars." And she says, "Really?" And he says, "I promise." And because she trusts, she lets go of the candy bar, and her arm slides out of the vending machine. What's your candy bar? You don't hang on to self-destructive, objectionable things for no reason. Alcoholism often appears as self-destructive behavior, but it's not. It's self-serving behavior, but it's delusional self-serving behavior. My mother and father spent thousands and thousands of dollars on rehabs before they cut me off, and psychiatrists, and they believed that I had some sort of self-destructive complex. Because, my God, I'd be 6 months sober. I got a good job. Everything's going very well. Everybody's saying, "Oh, my God, Bob's turned the corner. He's doing really well." And just about the time that things are really good, I'd burn the sucker to the ground. And they thought that I was insane. They thought that, he's self-destructive. They sent me to these psychiatrists. Self-destructive. Because to them, it looks like I'm just intermittently flinging myself out of a four-story window and getting all banged up and ending in the hospital. What they never see is experientially to me, the building's on fire. And I'm leap. It looks, by the time I take the leap, it looks like I'm going to die if I don't take the leap. Even though intellectually I know I will die if I might die taking the leap, but it feels real, real here that I'm dying if I don't. And that's a lot of, my internal reality is so disconnected from life itself at times. See, I think the building's on fire. The building's not on fire. When Clancy talks about this being a disease of perception, he's not kidding. It really is. And so, why do I hang on to this stuff? Because I'm deluded. I'm deluded. See, at one time it worked. All my defects of character are really and truly, they're defense mechanisms. They're things I've used to give me security. Anger and rage was a big one. I was so afraid that if I gave up anger, then who's going to stand up for me when somebody tries to take advantage of me? I'll be a punk. People will roll over me. The problem is, the truth is, my acting out in anger has not helped me. It's cost me jobs, relationships, friendships. I got, my nose wasn't always like this. Clint, my dear friend Clint, who I miss sometimes very much, used to have this great saying. He'd say to people who were telling him about what he's doing, he'd say, "So, how's that working for you?" And see, sometimes we wake up. The awakening is I get the reality that this there is no value in this behavior. You kind of do that with drinking, don't you, in the end? You kind of realize that this party's over. I can drink until I die, but I will never, ever, ever, ever get the effects from alcohol that I got when I was 20 years old. And once you know that, then AA starts looking better. As long as drinking's fun, AA is a hideous place. It's a place of people wanting to deprive you of things and restrict you and oh, it's horrible. It's a hideous place. When you get to the end of your rope with your drinking and you realize you've wrung all the fun out of it and you're just stuck in the problem phase, A looks a lot better. And when I get to the end of the rope with a defective character like that, God looks a lot better. God looks a lot better. And so, guys like me, whether it's problems at work, I'm stealing from my boss, or gambling, or sex, or dishonesty. I've appeared at times in my life to be almost a pathological liar. I do not lie because I'm a liar. I lie because I'm afraid. I'm terrified of what you'll think of me. I'm terrified of the confrontation. So I lie. I believe an old lie that lies perpetrate lies, and the old lie is as is. You ain't gonna like me. You know why? Because I know everything about me and I don't like me. So I have to be something I'm not to you because I can't trust the reality. And then what happens? You wear that out. You start feeling phony in AA. It talks about that in chapter 6. We more than most, we live the double life. And I can't live a double life here. I get lost. The double life always turns into deep, deep depression for me as I sink into the abyss that exists between who I really know I am and who I so pathetically and desperately would like to have you think I am. I would rather have you dislike me for who I am than adore me for who I'm not. And I think my job in Alcoholics Anonymous is twofold. One is to grow towards God's vision of what Bob is and to be genuine and honest about my imperfection and getting there every bit of the way. To be vulnerable and let you know who I am. There's a vision of spiritual growth that I heard many years ago that I really got it. And that spiritual growth is an ongoing realization of my own limitations and God's incredible generosity. that really I have not, I can't do anything without him. I really am, as time goes on, more and more powerless. And we live in a society that doesn't take well to powerless. We live in a society that perpetrates this, and as the years go on and our technology increases, it increases the illusion that knowledge is power. If you know better, you'll do better. I've known better and done worse. That's the hell. It's no. I've always known. That's the problem. I've always known how I should be. That's why I drink, because I have a conscience that knows. The problem is I don't have the power to carry it out. So I really need God. There was an American Indian story years ago, and I've shared this with a lot of people over the years. It's kind of spread around the internet much. And it's the story of this young brave who goes to the shaman, the wise man in the tribe, and he's very conflicted and he's confused. And he goes to the old man and he says, "Old man, I don't understand my life." And the old man says, "What seems to be the problem and the conflict?" He said, "Well, for some reason, there are days when I feel connected to the Great Spirit. There are days when I have a love in my heart for the people in the tribe, and I want to help the women in the village, and I want to run with the braves, and I feel community, and I feel a tremendous love and a part of. And then there are other days when I just resent them all, and I resent their how they intrude into my, want to intrude into what I'm doing and my thinking and thoughts and actions, and how they don't mind their own business, and they don't do things right, and nobody does things right, and I hate them, and I'm full of anger and rage. And why is this, old man?" And the old man says, "Son, your life is like two dogs trapped in a battle and a fight to their mortal death. And they're stuck in this sack and they can't get out, and they'll fight until one of them dies." And the brave says, "Well, which one wins?" And he says, "The one that you feed." Inherent in guys like me, the book calls us extreme examples of self-will run right. It doesn't say, "Bob, you're a little self-will. Bob, you're off the charts. You're, whoa. Ugh. Oh." Inherent in guys like that, internally focused guys, thinkers, guys that go up in here into the bridge of the Starship Enterprise and pull this stuff up on it, from up in here, from within me, it never makes sense to feed the dog I should really be feeding. I will always pick the wrong dog, left alone, because the clamoring of self is much louder than the still small voice of God within me. It always is. And the problem is, at the times when I need God's direction the most is the times that I'm usually the most blocked from God. Because this is just going nuts. See, now when I'm really free and don't have anything I'm afraid of and nothing's on me, me and God, hey, we should get a tent and a tambourine because I'm ready here. Well, there's really no intuition to get when you're right in the beam. I mean, there's nothing. What do I need? I mean, and that's the problem. I think, what do I need, God? You know, I don't say that because that's not a good AA thing to say. But I kind of start positioning. I'm doing so well. I start positioning myself as if, you know, God, you did a pretty good job, but I think I'll take it from here. I don't even know I'm doing that. When I do that, I don't even know I'm doing that until I start, till the wheels start coming off. And then I really need God. And the problem is I've disconnected myself from God. Because the problem with God is not, he doesn't move away from me. I just get too much of me between me and him. And that's the problem. And I will always need a sponsor. I will not only just a sponsor, I have a network of guys that I trust, that I am transparent with. There's some people in this room that I would tell them anything about me. There's people in this room that know everything about me, and they still like me. Wow. And I know everything about them, and I love them for it. So I will always need you. I will always need God with skin on. I have to have that. This is not, there are big book technicians that float around the fellowship that want to hone themselves into such a state of spiritual perfection they rise above the fellowship and glow in the dark, but that's, I think that's a bad way to go. That's a Jim Jones move, man. That's a David Koresh has come to the 12 steps move. I will always need you. And I hope to God that I stay humble enough to act like it. And that really is the whole kit and caboodle right there. Can I remain humble enough that when I have a problem in my life, even though your head's going, Bob, don't say anything. This will make you look really bad. Vince Yeo used to say, sometimes you have to be willing to look bad in order to feel good. And I pray to God I can always maintain enough of His grace in my life to be humble enough that if I'm in trouble, to tell you I'm in trouble. Because I can't help myself. I don't have the power. And I never have. I've had times in my sobriety where I've deluded myself into thinking of what I've done. But it really is nothing but that. It's a delusion. But I do my part in God's grace. I catch the grace. I set the sail. I take the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I keep you in my life. I stay active in a home group. There's something about accountability here that is so important. I'm not only accountable to my sponsor and my sponsees, but to my home group and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I show up. And I show up like I'm enthusiastic, even like I don't feel like it. I show up early for my commitments. And I show up early for my commitments on days when I don't want to get out of bed. And isn't it funny how you take the actions and the thing that was on you starts to lift? Bill Wilson, it was mentioned earlier by one of the other speakers, and it's really been my experience. The real gist of perfecting and enlarging my spiritual life is always in self-sacrifice and always in service and helping others. It's never in self-indulgence. It's never in self-anything. It's always in you. And it's always showing up. And the more inconvenient AA is, it seems like the more spiritual growth. Right? I have some friends. I had one guy, I had to let him go a couple years ago because he only wanted to go to meetings that were convenient. I thought, that's terrible. I mean, what dog are you feeding here? You're not feeding the right. My home group. We're all over town. We're like a garage sale. We're all over the place. And I drive 25 miles off to some of the meetings. I can drive by 3-4 meetings on the way to my home group, and I'll be glad to do it. And I get there an hour early, and I stand out there and I greet. I think greeting is one of the greatest jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you go in there and you remember that all of us on any given day can walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and have so much of ourselves on ourselves that we don't fit there. And when you can remember the days when you've been like that, then you can stand at the door of a meeting and you can make a guy that's just like you feel a little bit better about walking through that doorway. And this is really a program of self-abandonment. And I want to talk a couple minutes about the seventh step prayer. I think it is one of the most beautiful, not only beautiful prayers in Alcoholics Anonymous, it shines a laser-like focus on what we're about, that Alcoholics Anonymous is not and never was and never will be a self-help program. It's a program of self-abandonment and service. That the whole point here is not to make me better. The whole point here is to make me useful. Because in serving God's kids, I grow closer to Him. I've never been closer to God than when I'm helping one of His kids. I've had moments, and I want you to understand, I pray a minimum of twice a day, and I meditate, I do all that stuff, but I'll tell you, I've never through prayer and meditation felt as close to God as I have sometimes on the back end of a fifth step, listening to a fifth step, or spending 2 hours with a guy that's shaking it out. I tell you, there's something about that that just pushes me completely out of the way, and God shows up. Chamberlain used to say, you don't have to find God, you just have to reduce you, because God deplores a vacuum. And so in this process of self-abandonment, I say this prayer to my maker after I've been saying the asking for the willingness. And I say, My creator, He made me. He's more of me than I am. He knows more about Bob than Bob will ever know about Bob. My creator, there's nothing here that has to be held out or fixed up. I don't have to get good to come to God. He made me. My creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. See, I thought, I grew up with a mindset that I didn't deserve God. The reason I threw God out is I believed that I was never going to be good enough. I am the kind of person by nature, if I just suspect you don't like me, I'm going to not like you first. Right? And I did that with God. And to my amazement, matter of fact, I tell you something I believe. I think the more decrepit you are, the more God loves you. You know why I believe that? Watch. Come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Keep your eyes and ears open. Watch the hand of God work through the people in AA, and you will see it reach out the strongest to the most broken and decrepit. That God could have all of me, good and bad. I pray that now, Lord, that you now remove for me every single defect of character. And here's the qualifier. Every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness. I wouldn't have wrote that. I got to think of a lot of lines in there besides usefulness that stands in the way of everybody realizing what a wonderful guy Bob is. I want God to make me into the person that when I walk into the room, people go, I touched the hem of his garment. Or couldn't you say, it stands in the way of my being happy? For God's sake, don't I get happy? I'll tell you something, I've had happy. I would rather have useful. Happy, the shine wears off of it so quickly. Useful will change your whole relationship with this world. It'll change your relationship with you until you eventually, if you're useful long enough, you become the person that puts his head on the pillow and you sleep the good sleep because you're doing exactly what you'd been divinely crafted to do. Alcoholics Anonymous is amazing. It's the only place on the planet that will take broken people and use the most despicable things about you to help others. I mean, when you think about it, we get somebody that comes into AA and they're so ashamed of themselves. My kid's in the hospital because in a drunken rage I broke his legs and I threw hot water on him. He's got third degree burns and I want to die and I can't believe I did that. I got five people you can talk to that in drunken rages have created that kind of child abuse. And those five people who loathe themselves for what they did are trying to make an amends to their kids, and now they're using that experience to let other people know they're not alone. You just came into a meeting and your wife's leaving you. You're 10 years sober and you did a relationship workshop last year. And everybody found out that you were cheating on your wife through the whole marriage. We got five people we need you to talk to. And a ton of newcomers coming into Alcoholics Anonymous over the next couple of years that are going to need you. Because in God's hands, the worst things about you become the best. In the light of our primary purpose, where else could a guy like me bring his decrepitness and have God make it useful? I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't had to be anything here except who I am. And that took a lot of years to risk. Thanks for listening.